Thank you.
We won, Mayor.
I know.
Yay.
It started. Hi, Marion. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Good morning, everyone. It's a good night's sleep in a beautiful place with bells ringing. And I just woke up this morning just really feeling just a peace here, you know, really sensitive to my surroundings. I think this walk and this journey with God, with all of us, you know, makes us a little more sensitive to things around us. You know, we can, like it says in our book, you know, we can go to the most sordid places on earth and we can still be at peace in the middle of that stuff. And that's beautiful. But it's also kind of nice to be somewhere where the peace is already kind of built in. It's nice. So I rested well, and I hope you did too. Loved last night, and just really getting to know everyone, and seeing just a unity, and people just hungry for more of God, hungry to know more about the Big Book. And I love when you were talking about your fan page, you know, that, or the page for the Big Book Experience. And, you know, we can have I've known people, tons of people over all my years of sobriety, some people that knew and quoted this Big Book like the back of their hand, that couldn't get sober or couldn't stay sober. I remember this little old man named Don, and he would be at dry dock, and he had the most ripped up, torn up Big Book I've ever seen, and died of this disease in an old folks home. You know, he just kept coming in and out and in and out, and we'd walk into the meeting and he'd quote the book, and he'd make the coffee and he'd be of service. And I don't know why that stuff happens, and I don't know why some of us get it experientially and some of us don't. I don't know why that happens. I know that there's a grace I can't explain, there's a psychic change that I can't explain. And I just know every single day that I'm humbled by the fact that I've gotten to walk this path, and I hope you are too. You know, and I think you are. So one of the books I read from, I just want to read from. It's just a little meditation book that I've read a little bit over the years. That was a gift from a beautiful woman. And I just felt like this is really fitting to us today, because that's what we're here. You know, this is a program of action, and we can never rest on our laurels. And one thing that I've known in my life through all the years of the things that I've seen that happen in this fellowship is people resting on their laurels, thinking they've arrived. Okay, now I can go to just one meeting a week, or I'll just call my sponsor now, or, you know, it's okay if I hang out at the casino, you know? So what if I think she's cute at a meeting and I'm going to wink at her, you know, and I'm married, you know? Things like that, you know, just a little simple ways that we can rest on our laurels, and like Peter was talking about last night, going backwards. So I just feel like this was really fitting. This is a beautiful book called God Calling, and it's by A.J. Russell, and there was two women, and they were getting messages from God. Has anybody heard of this book before?
Yeah.
They remained anonymous. They remained anonymous, and they came to a man named A.J. Russell, and they wrote down every message they got from God every single day for a year, and put it in writing and gave it to him. And I always find so much hope and so much comfort in this book. But for this morning, I feel like it's so us. It starts with the word progress. And progress is the law of heaven. Higher, ever higher. Rise to life and beauty, knowledge and power. Higher and higher. Tomorrow, be stronger, braver, more loving than you've been today. The law of progress gives meaning and a purpose to your life. So I just want to say a prayer, God, that we would not grow stagnant. God, that we would not take this beautiful, amazing gift you've given us for granted. God, that you would work in and through us over this weekend, God, that we would rely on you and depend on you wholeheartedly to move us in and through this experience, this experience with this book, this beautiful book that is so godly ordained, and to have tangible, beautiful experience with our Creator. Amen.
Amen.
So I was down on the beach. I'm doing a 12-step series, which I've never really done one by my. I've never done one by myself, and it scares the crap out of me. in Deerfield Beach on Monday nights, and Monday night I was out on the beach, and I'm up like in through like step six in this series, and it's one thing to do it side by side with someone else, you know, like you're. Or you just get up and you do a talk and you do a talk. The 12-step series all by yourself, there's something just extremely vulnerable about that. It's like I'm opening the book, I'm opening my heart, I'm just being me, messy, crazy me, you know? And one of the things that God laid on my heart Monday night was, you know, Peter was talking about the tragedy that happened in the last week, and you know, us moving in and through that. And when you're partnered with someone, you know, you're married, two people become one. You know, when Peter hurts, I hurt for him. And when I hurt, he hurts for me. And, you know, that's how things are. And there was a, so I'm down on the beach and I'm praying. I got my smoothie, you know, and I'm hanging out down at the beach and I'm praying. And one of the things that God really laid on my heart was, a writing that Bill Wilson had in The Language of the Heart. And in it, he has a writing on emotional sobriety. And I'd like to read some of that to you because there's certain places in our sobriety where we can, like we talked about, we can start going backwards. We can go backwards through the steps and all those things. And Bill was a man who suffered with depression. He suffered with depression, and he got to this place where it was just depression, and he was trying to connect with the St. Francis prayer. He was trying to connect with it to love rather than to, who we all know the St. Francis prayer, right? And I have it pulled up if you don't know it. So I just would like to read a little bit of this. And he says, I kept asking myself, why can't the 12-step work to release my depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It's better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula, all right, but why didn't it work? Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence on people or circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionist dreams and specifications, I had fought for them, and when defeat came, so did my depression. And so what I had found for myself is, you know, trying to comfort someone, you know, we're down there in this business, and we sponsor a lot of people, so that's what we do off the clock. We, you know, we do what we do for fun and for free, but we also do it, like the big book says, some of us make a vocation of it, and that is what we do. And you know, it's like some people get it and some people don't. There's the joy of the people that get it, and then there's the sorrow, the complete horrendous sorrow of the people that don't get it. And in this writing, what I got from this so much was that that dependent, like I can't be attached, we can't be attached to the success, and we can't be attached to the sorrow. What we can be attached to is this living Creator and the God. And, you know, like, back in, when you read, I don't even remember what the statement's called, and it used to be in the halls, just the AA state, the AA statement, that I am responsible statement. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out, I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that I am responsible. And sometimes that isn't my hand. Sometimes that's somebody else. And you know what? If the phone call's made, I've got to pass it on to somebody else. And, you know, Bill sat there when this program first started, and quite honestly, I believe Lois Wilson was a Mother Teresa, you know? I always picture when the statement happened that they were standing at the kitchen sink. I don't know why I get this, but I do. You know, and Bill came in and he had worked with others and worked with others and worked with others and worked with others, and no one was getting sober. And he was devastated by this. You know, he's like, Lois, I'm trying and it's not working. It's not working. And Lois looked at him and she said, yes, Bill, but you're sober. Wow. And I believe that's where this movement came from. She had not said that, if she'd have said, okay, Bill, hang it up. You're tired, buddy. You know? You're tired. I get it. I get it. You're tired. And she agreed with that, but she said, no, you are. And so that's what we do, you know, we're in the firing lines, all of us are in the firing lines, and it's like we can't be attached to the outcome, that this one is an oh yay, and oh, and this one is an oh yay, you know, because like when the sorrows happen, it's like, what did I do wrong? And we don't even catch ourselves doing that, and I'm not saying that we take credit for that stuff, but just attaching to the sorrow of it and attaching to, you know, whatever. I hope that makes sense. I'm not great at finishing sentences sometimes when I get on the road. Well, just sometimes, like, you know, it's like God gives it to you, and it's like, God, I got to keep up with this. So, and I'm only on my second cup of Starbucks. Just so you know, when you travel, buy little instant packages of Starbucks. We're like, we like that, right, basically. So he goes on to say, I could not avail myself of God's love until I was able to offer it back to him by loving others as he would have me. And it couldn't be possible to do that as long as I was victimized by false dependencies. For my dependency meant demand, a demand for the possession and control of the people and the conditions surrounding me. While the words absolute dependency may look like a gimmick, they were the ones that helped to trigger my release into the present degree of stability and quietness of mind, qualities which I am now trying to consolidate by offering love to others regardless of the return to me. The real stabilizing thing for him was having an offering love to that strange drunk on the doorstep. That was St. Francis at work, powerful and practical, minus dependency and minus demand. In the first 6 months of my own sobriety, I worked hard with many alcoholics. Not one responded, yet this work kept me sober. It wasn't a question of those alcoholics giving me anything. My stability came out of trying to give, not out of demanding that I received. Thus, I think it can work out with emotional sobriety. If we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy dependency and its consequent unhealthy demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. Then we can be set free to live and love. We may then be able to 12-step ourselves and others into emotional sobriety. This is what he says in closing in this. Of course, I haven't offered you a real new idea, only a gimmick that started to unhook several of my own hexes at death. Nowadays, my brain is no longer racing compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I love this last line. I've been given a quiet place and bright sunshine. So that's from our founder, and beautiful.
Good morning, Peter, recovered alcoholic.
Peter.
Grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred political alcoholics anonymous. Thank you. I say recovered because I am. Anything less than that great fact would be falsely humble. But loving God took me from the scrap heap, June of 88, to where I am this morning, and getting recovered. I don't say that to be special or unique from anyone. It's just the great fact is the first promise in the book, and what I need to get to do is bear witness to that. And what I'm happy to report, the good news is that I've been recovered from alcoholism as well, not just the obsession of the mind and obviously the phenomenon called craving, but those bedevilments, those things that haunt us, those demons that lay in the back of the head and want to spring up at any time. But as I said last night, if I start to unravel and start to rest on my laurels, those things start to wake up and they start to run the show again. And I start to experience current unmanageability, which is a state of consciousness that I live in with my effort to live life on self-will. And when those things happen, the external world absolutely owns me. I'm attached to everything and everyone, approval, money, you name it, I need it to feel good. And attachments are the things that block me from God. They overshadow the voice. They overshadow the light of God when I'm attached to things. And what's really cunning, baffling, and powerful about this illness is that we can't hear it and we can't see it. We just become it. I don't do well with abstinence. I'm probably more dangerous sober without a spiritual path than drunk, because when I'm drunk, I usually sit in the corner and pass out. I eat pills, I drink, and I just lay there and go out and come up and start all over again. That's how it was at the end for me. It's when I'm sober and I'm untreated and I become very dangerous. So I don't do well to abstinence. I don't have a good reaction to just being abstinence. What I need is a spiritual path. And on the subject of unmanageability, there was a guy I remember when I was first coming around. I was just back from Minnesota, and we had the, you know, after the meeting, we go to the diner and have another meeting and have something to eat. And I was living in Brooklyn, New York at the time. And there was a guy in there who was reciting the Big Book, similar to the friend you knew. And he knew Big Book, he knew traditions, he was going to concepts. The guy was really knowledgeable. And somewhere in his discussion over coffee and dinner, he said he had 7 days back. And I know it alarmed me, but I couldn't understand what the message was. Why was I in front of this guy? Until much later. And then I realized that knowledge will not keep me sober. Our book talks about that. And quite frankly, a lot of us, including me, don't need more information. What we need is a transformation. We have a book, we have a methodology that works, and we incorporate all these other things. By the way, there should be a Bible up there, but that's another but I don't need education. I don't need more information. I've had enough. I'm sober a long time. What I still need to do is grow in understanding and effectiveness. And when I think I've arrived or have gobbled up enough information, and all it does is rest in the head, that very information that got me a point will now take me, that information will take me away. I have just enough knowledge not to need God. I have just enough information not to need God. And so what I start to do is excuse a lot of unspiritual behavior and make it very spiritual. And I start to unravel. And the frightening thing is I can't see it. My words are no longer impeccable. In fact, in another book, it says, it's not what goes in the mouth of a man that hurts him, it's what comes out that defiles him. And I stop going to God. Now, hopefully, some of us will bottom out while we're sober and experiencing unmanageability, where we can then turn back to this power. But very few of us do. And it's really, I found a lot of folks who go out with double-digit sobriety find it incredibly difficult to come back again. My sponsor gave me a consideration, a statement one time. He said, think about this. It says, he said to me, God speaks through brick walls. And I was dumbfounded by this. I didn't know what that meant. And he explained to me exactly what it meant. If I'm faced with the brick wall or blocked in by four brick walls, the first thing I'm going to do if I got to get out is start trying to climb up, go under it, around it, punch it, pull it down, whatever I have to do, until I'm so bloodied and tatted and torn that then there's no way out. And what do? I drop to my knees and I surrender. Please get me out of this. Please help me. And at that point, in a place of surrender, when I'm begging for mercy, in fact, if my prayers aren't one of surrender, if I'm not talking to God of surrender, I'm really not talking to God at all. And so when I'm surrounded by these brick walls and there is no way to go and I tried everything possible, I sort of ran out of road and I dropped my knees and I begged for mercy, suddenly I hear God say, there's a doorway in the corner, walk out. And it's only when I'm faced with that I start to hear God speaking through brick walls. So what sort of current unmanageability we have, and what is the solution for it? What we tend to do, and I've tended to do over the years, as soon as I experience some sort of trauma, some sort of dilemma, some sort of crisis, some sort of something that makes me uncomfortable, the first thing we tend to do is try to figure it out. And as soon as I get into the figuring out part, I am now in the self-managing department. And my book says in How It Works, I'm an alcoholic and cannot manage my own life, that's drunk or sober. I'm an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable, that's drunk or sober, as soon as I put my hands on the wheel. And the ego demands that. The ego wants me to be obedient to it. The false self, the thinking mind, wants me to be obedient to all its demands and never ever entertain the possibility of hope or God. And I usually succumb to that all the time. And I justify and rationalize all my behavior away because, after all, it is me. And I can cut a corner, and I don't have to be so disciplined today. And yet, if we continue, as I have, to surrender to this power, we get disciplined to the spiritual life. I came to terms with the realization that my life is none of my business. I don't have a life. I know that sounds really lame if anyone's in here new. But I don't have a life. It belongs to God, and I like it that way because any time I thought my life was my business, I usually ran right into a brick wall. My sobriety is none of my business either. God allows me to participate in this journey as if it is, and I get to chop wood and carry water. But I'm not in charge of my sobriety. What I am supposed to do is suit up and show up and hit the altar and beg for mercy for another day reprieve and to go out and to carry the vision of God's will into all my activities, not mine. What I've also been made very clear of is that June 23rd, 1988, I get rescued. The pilot light gets turned on and here I am this morning. God got me sober. And that's just the gospel truth, I tell you. I'm clear that I didn't get me sober. I had nothing to do with this except running out of road. And the reason, one of the conditions God got me sober was not to have a nice job, not to have a nice relationship, not to live in Florida. It was to go out and get the wounded soldiers and bring them back here and minister them. Our primary purpose, stay sober and help another drunk achieve sobriety. That is the reason why God got me sober. And anything else that I get is truly from him. My home, my job, my money, my car, my no money, my no car, my no job is from him. Because here's what I found out. And this is how we kind of stay in line with God's will. We tend to think God is this guy who's handing out $100 bills when I want them, giving me opportunities on my terms. Am I willing to play by someone else's rules? His rules? Or am I still surrendering to God in one side of my face and the other part of me is saying, yeah, but it's on my terms still? God's way of giving is by removing, like the process of recovery is the death of self for successful living. The absolute removal and the death of me before the physical death. If one of our children was running around the house with a sharp knife, we would immediately take it from them because we love them. It's what God does with me when I'm heading on a path that I think is kind of fun, and he pulls me back, takes the relationship away, takes the money away, takes the job away, takes the possessions, the material things away. He's done this all to me, and I would always recoil saying, God, why are you punishing me? When I get to the other side, I realize, no, God was loving me over and over and over again. The things I think are good for me, God says, no, they are not. And the realization is that my mind, even though I like to say it has shut down, it is still breathing and looking for a little crack in the armor to get in there and just pull me on its path. And I won't even know when it's happening. In doctor's opinion, he's talking about the drink. But how do I get the book to meet us where we currently are? We're sober 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 30 years, and we've gone through the work a whole bunch of times. We know the book really well. How do I get to meet this book where I currently am and to examine any current unmanageability that I have? And in the third edition, the bottom of Roman numeral 26, it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. What am I doing because I like the effect produced by it? Gambling, shopping, money, porn, sex, food, the gym, whatever it might be, 13-stepping, gossiping. I derive a good sense of self when I gossip about you because I just put myself on a little pedestal. You are down there. I and my friends are up here. How often am I doing that and then walking into a room and claiming to be spiritual? Right. What am I getting? What am I feeling good about? Am I worshiping my emotions rather than the power? I need to feel good. Don't screw up my serenity. I'll go to another meeting. Hey, I was in a meeting one time in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and there was a wet one in there. And it blows my mind when a wet one comes into some of our meetings, how AAs go, oh my God, he's drunk. Well, it says AA outside. And this guy was, you know, loud, and he was just mumbling to himself. And instead of, perhaps he was disturbing the meeting, instead of anyone picking him up and trying, you know, walking him outside, which I wind up doing, and they thought I was a lunatic for doing it, because he smelled and he was dirty. One woman got up, and I knew her. She was sober at the time, probably 15 years, and she says, this is obscene. He's affecting my serenity, and went to another meeting. That happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, the sensation is so elusive that while we admit as injurious, we cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. I will behave unspiritually based on a lie, never on the truth. I will pick up a drink on a lie, never on the truth. Because for me, truth is synonymous with God and wholeness of mind. Huh? To them, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Well, I do go to meetings. I have double-digit sobriety. I'm sponsoring a lot of men. But on the way home, I don't go directly home to see the wife. I have a couple of rendezvous I have to make. She don't know about it, but that's okay. And we start to act like this. Or perhaps I'm sponsoring a lot of men and I have a lot of commitments and I've earned this false reputation. People hold you in high regard, but I have an eye on the little ladies who were sober 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, 8 months, 7 months, and I'm a little 13-stepper. And I'm not going to look to go all the way, but I like the feeling derived by the new girls looking at me. And the women do the same with the boys. How spiritual is that in a sacred room called Alcoholics Anonymous? It's what we call hypocrisy. But I continue to do it because there's some feeling good that I come away with. And I become attached to my emotions and my feelings. I need to feel good. I need to feel good about me. And I'm getting that by what you think of me, what she thinks of me. I'm back in bondage and I don't even know it. This is all unmanageability. At some point, that's going to grab me by the leg and pull me right into the bar. And I don't know what that day looks like when it does show up. The illness usually wins. I can't see suddenly coming down the block. When he said suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that an ounce of whiskey in my milk would look good. I can't see suddenly coming. I can't call up the sponsor and say, hey, Scott, suddenly he's down the block. Can you come get me? Suddenly just kicks the door open, grabs me by the throat, and I'm drunk. It says we're restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless I can again experience a sense of ease and comfort comes at once by taking a few drinks or fill in the blank. I can't tell you how many men have come to me, and they start to get restless, irritable, and discontented because they stopped working with spiritual disciplines. And they're locked up on their computer, you know what they're doing. And then they try to have this double life come into Alcoholics Anonymous with some expectations of what was supposed to feel like and be like in AA, and they have this other dark life that has now gotten in the way. It's overshadowing everything, and they're trying to shift back in, and they can't because that is now a new obsessive compulsive behavior, and there is no God in there, and they won't surrender to it. They won't beg for mercy to have that removed from them because it's working for them like booze worked for them. It is the drink. And one of the most frightening things we can experience is if I'm getting some sort of instant gratification in something, even though I know it's hurting me, I'm probably not going to surrender to it because now I stand before you in the raw, and that is just too painful. I have this little thing I can go to and I can escape for a while, whether it's gambling or food or sex. And no, the secret sex life, the secret money life, I can always go to that. Kind of like when we go to a doctor after surgery and he gives us pain pills for a couple of days post-surgery, which some of us have to do. And we're done with that after 3 days, but we keep the bottle of 55 other pills in the medicine cabinet, the just-in-case day. You never know. That's not a good sign. So we have this secret life just in case. And that grows like cancer, and it starts to permeate other areas of my life. I can't hear you anymore because I have something else going on. I can't even see you anymore because I'm blinded by something else. And when I speak to you, I'm not really listening. I'm just trying to fix you up real quick so I can go back to doing what I was doing. And as soon as I leave a meeting of AA, it's on me again. And what's really frightening when we're sitting in a meeting of AA and half of us are here and the other half is somewhere else. All forms of current unmanageability, that if they're not surrendered to God and only to God, I can talk to my sponsor about it. He will give me direction. He will help navigate through it. And when I'm in a confession like with the sponsor, which is what that is, when I sit down with the sponsor, it's confession. Inventory is confession. If I'm sitting down in a cup of coffee and talking to my sponsor about some of my concerns or my fears or resentment, more confession. That's only half the battle. What I need to do is go back to the boss and surrender once again. And it's in that experiencing of my being finite in my humanness, that realization that allows me to get free and accomplish so much more. What drives me back to God? This book is about driving us back to God. Working with others is about driving a drunk back to God. And if that ruffled feathers in some of our contemporary A meetings, tough. Welcome to the NFL. I'd rather be accused of telling you the truth and piss you off than accused of telling you a lie and have to go 12-step you because of the information I gave you. So if we're walking with this book, trust me, you will catch some heat. You will experience resistance. But how did we find our teachers? Because they stood before a crowd and said, here's the information, here is the truth. The truth will set you free, but it might piss you off along the way, huh? The truth will set you free. The truth will set you free. The carpenter said, I am the truth. We turn to God, that's what we're talking about. The truth. The truth comes from one thing, the higher power, God, whatever you want to call it. For me, it's a carpenter. That's the truth. Your God is the truth. And that's the only being, if you will, power that's going to get us past us. I'm an alcoholic with an ego twice the size of this room and an inferiority complex. I'm hypersensitive, self-centered, self-absorbed, self-seeking, the ego that endorses that. The only thing that's going to remove that is not you, is him. But I come to you anyway. I pray when I do these talks that I never show up. And what I mean by that is I get to be here. It's an opportunity. I have a life of invitation. So you invited me here, so I suit up and show up. But you don't want Pete Marinelli from Brooklyn, New York, showing up to do this talk. Because what that guy wants to do is just shake a few hands and go hang out outside and smoke cigars. What that guy wants is anything I do say, you must approve of. In fact, you better worship me by the time I get done. You better love me and adore me by the time I get done. Because anything less than that, I'm going to have a problem with you. See that? You don't want him showing up. That guy wants to sound profound. That guy wants to sound like Moses and insightful. That's the egotistical, insecure guy. He's somewhere out there. I hope he never shows up again. But the realization for me, he's gone dormant. The false self has gone dormant. Will he ever die? I don't know. He hasn't shown up in a while. You don't want him showing up. I pray he doesn't show up. That's why before I do these things, I get really quiet. When we do them together, we do a lot of prayer. And my thing is, don't let me show up. And I go into a four-hour fast, and I do a whole bunch of meditation. And I ask God to speak through me. Do not let me speak for them, to them. That's being disciplined for me to the spiritual life. My book tells me this. After we have succumbed to the desire again, whatever that might be, And that's a conclusion of the mind that this is okay to do. I pass through the well-known stages of a spree, whatever that spree is. It says I emerge remorseful with the firm resolution not to drink again or not to do the spree again. And then it says this is repeated over and over. And unless I can experience an entire, not a partial, entire psychic change, there's little hope of my recovery. So they're talking about the drink here, or if you're into substances, the substance. But let's talk about current unmanageability. What dark alleyway am I going down to experience some sort of okayness, some sort of relief? That stuff will give us relief temporarily, only to come back with the next day's emotional hangover. And what I'm here to report to you is that this book, this God, and this fellowship, and the instructions we find in the book will not give you relief. The 12 steps is not going to give you relief. If you're looking for relief, go bowling. Go to the beach. Find a new lover. What the book and God and my fellowship, our fellowship, will give us is freedom. How free do we want to be? What an order I can't go through with it, because it means everything I think I am, who I be, is a lie. In order to experience the truth, the false must die. And we're about to come face to face with our own demons. One of the things we get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous through this work in 1969 is come face to face, eyeball to eyeball, with our own demons. Are we ready to meet them? Because they're going to go. And we will quickly see how a lot of us are locked into a few of them. The just-in-case demons. I can't do this walk in the raw, forgetting that God's the one who's walking for me. There's a great story that I read. The teacher is with the student. It's a snow-covered road. And the teacher tells the student, begin to walk and follow the path. And the student looks back at the teacher and says, there is no path, just snow. He says, begin to walk, and when you look back, you will see the path. Growth doesn't occur until we step into the unknown. Kind of outside our comfort zone, what some of us like to call it. It's a new dimension of existence. When our book says we've been rocketed into this fourth dimension of existence, they're talking about getting past what we were dominated by for so long, our obsessions, our compulsions, and our emotions. The drink and drug is off me, but I need to feel good all the time. So we get rocketed past that into this godly place, not worldliness anymore, and we're not worshiping us, ourselves, or my needs and my wants. It's about serving God and only serving God. And once we begin to serve God, we're not a slave to the world, and I find myself going home full all the time and content and grateful, having the attitude of gratitude for little things. And instead of having to do something, and I must do something, and I better do something, I work what I get to. I get to go to meetings. I get to work with a sponsor. I get to go to a dentist. I get to go to work. I get to. Because the alternative is chasing another drink and going down the dark alleys and leading a double life and trying to convince you that I'm okay. The only time I really should be talking is when I detach from my own thoughts. And something about when we detach from our thinking, we find peace with ourselves, because if I'm not thinking, I'm probably speaking with God, I'm in line with God, which means I don't need to speak, only if you ask me. But if we're talking a lot, we have an answer for everything, you're asking me a question, I'm worried about the comeback because you need to think I'm Moses, I'm thinking a lot. And my ego's in full play. But you will meet very religious people, very spiritual people. They really don't say much unless you pose a question to them. I bet you if we went to one of the brothers and says, hello, brother, how are you? Hey, what's happened? How's everything? You watch the game? They don't do that stuff. Good morning. That's enough. I don't need to stop purging all over you. You ever see two drunks or untreated talk? They keep trying to jump in on each other. I'm listening to you. I really don't care about you. Just listen to me. Most of us are like this. Let's not talk about me. let's talk about you. What do you think of me? Well, this is how we operate. You're a little slow on the draw, Scott. There's one more thing I'd like to share with you. On page 24, it says this. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, we pass into the state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. So I have this unmanageability going on. And I've come to terms with this is not good. I'm losing money. I'm spending money in places I shouldn't be spending money. I'm behaving in ways that aren't good. I'm gossiping a lot. And I really want to stop. I really want to stop, and I can't. Again, the book meets me exactly where I am. It says, the fact is most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice and drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. This is across the board for every single area of my life. Lack of power, we're going to read in a second, is my dilemma. I don't have power. For me, in my book, the most powerful line for me in my book is chapter 2, Gnostics, page 45, when it says, lack of power is my dilemma. That sums me up. I think I have power, but I really don't. Lack of power is my dilemma. With power, no dilemma. Where do I find this power? It says, our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. I am unable at certain times to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'm without defense against the first drink. So I just come off a sex spree. I just come off a money spree. I just come off a whatever spree. I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to do it again, only to repeat it again and again, because I don't have legs under me anymore. I'm all over page 52. I've become a poster child of page 52, and at some point it becomes so great that I go back to what I know works all the time, and that's the drink, or the powder, or the pipe, or the pills, just like that. This illness is not going to announce its arrival. It just shows up. And the relapse happens, once we pick up a drink, the relapse is over. The relapse happens with the untreated behavior, the unspiritual thinking. And I folks, I'm not talking about that one day where you get those days, where you're just in a bit of a depression. You're just, something's hooked you, a resentment has hooked you, just something. I'm not talking about that once in a while thing. I'm talking about this has now become the rhythm. You know, you wake up at 6 a.m. to start your day, and you're getting dressed, and you knock over a cup of coffee. It's 5 after 6 in the morning, and you go, it's going to be one of those days. It's 5 after 6, and you spill coffee. But we will let that determine the rest of the day. God's got it in for me. I break a shoelace. I break a cuffling. Oh, my God. It's going to be, I go out the door and go, who's going to get me next? There's a book you guys just gave away about the power of intention. What am I putting out into the universe? I'm going to get it back. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer or whatever it might be don't crowd into my mind to deter us, because we're on this just one more time cycle, over and over and over again. And the only thing for me to do is to pick up a set of spiritual tools. And this is why I love going through the work at least once a year for annual house cleaning and seeing where God takes me. So what do? When we hit bottom in sobriety because of current unmanageability, or we hit bottom out there and 43 pages, and some of doctor's opinion we can throw in that mix, tells me over and over and over again that I'm going to drink. That I'm going to drink, and I don't have the power. A powerful desire is absolutely no avail. Consequences not to drink mean nothing. In the face of disaster, I will still pick up a drink. I will always buy the lie, and the truth might kill me, and I still continue to drink. I will be put, as Marion said, in detox, and 3 days later, my mind says, overreacted, one more drink, I'll go on marijuana maintenance. What are we going to do? We get painted into a corner, and there is no way out, and we're feeling terribly screwed and wronged. It is a great thing. It's more despair, which is needed to crush the ego some more. And what they do is they bring us to step two, which is a pointer to the solution. There is a way out. And we agnostics talks to us about how to find a higher power, where to find a higher power, and even why to find a higher power. And one of the best things they talk about in this chapter is to lay aside old ideas about God. The spiritual path is not necessarily a religious path. I come in here with perceptions and conceptions about God, about recovery, about religion, about spirituality. And they're saying, hey, you're not right, you're not wrong, it's not up, it's not down, it's not left, it's not right. We're just asking you to just put it aside for a moment and just hear what we have to say. And one of the greatest things I got in AA when I first came in was my own conception, no matter how inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach. It's a mustard seed of willingness that'll move the mountain. Am I willing to go to any lengths based on my first step experience? What do you got? When I was out there doing drugs, if Scott came up to me and says, a new thing out here, that polka dot pills, they really work. Give me a dozen. I'll try anything. You go to the bar, there's some stuff just came out, some new vibe. Yeah, let me try it. I mean, we're very willing to do that. No due diligence. Right? What do you, yeah, you look like that from that. Give me some. Yet we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and someone says, we're going to do a fourth step. We're going to read some of these spiritual books. You go, hold on. Let me see the spreadsheet on all this stuff. All of a sudden, we do due diligence. We got to get opinions. Did you hear about this book? That's when I was out there, I couldn't care. If you feel good, give me twice.
Right.
Okay. So it's asking me just to lay stuff aside. They're not even telling me my religious leanings are wrong. They don't even discuss religion. They're just saying, lay stuff aside. And for me, it was the G-O-D. From the gift of desperation, I came in here and I found power with you guys. I found safety in the numbers. When the old timers would start off, would say, hey, kids, sit with us. And then they would say, hey, Peter, sit with us. I felt like I was part of this group. And I felt safe. It became a G-O-D, a group of drunks, that you guys were giving me good, orderly direction. And it was only out of the gift of desperation that I was listening, that the heart was opened up so I can hear. What's interesting that happens to folks like me is through the gift of desperation, indeed the miraculous happens. 4 years, people, psychiatrists, priests, my dad, my uncles, my younger brothers, beatings, kicks, punishments, arrests, police, would try to get me from point A to point B. The arrows fell short. June 23rd, 1988, I'm completely dismantled. There is nothing left. I'm split wide open. And all it took, when we're like that, is one word, or one phrase, or one testimony, and the entire alcoholic wall comes down, and we go from bridge to shore. Mm-hmm. That's all it takes to bust right through. And for me, that was a man named Vince Dowling. I was talking about him last night when I showed up in his office with maybe 10 days sober, completely ripped apart. He was an EAP from my union. I didn't even know what these things were. And he said to me, I never did this before you showed up, and I never did it after. But something spoke to my heart. And he turned in a swivel chair. The guy looked just like Dr. Bob, by the way. I didn't know who Dr. Bob was at the time. But I was impressed by this how impeccable he was with his dress. And he had the straw hat on his desk. And he turned to me and he says, I'm an alcoholic. And he got my attention. This well-dressed, stunning man. Pleated down the shirt, the pants, shoes, polished hair, immaculate. Just perfect. And he started to give me the Reader's Digest version of what it was like, what happened, and where he was now. And I was sharing with someone last night. I remember thinking to myself, finally, someone gets me. He feels like me. He thinks like me. He drank like me, which is a great assignment to do the first 9 pages of Bill's story with. How did I drink like Bill, feel like Bill, think like Bill? And on Vince D's words, when he said, I'm going to send you to Minnesota, I didn't know anything about Minnesota, but as long as I can speak to Vince, I'll go to Timbuktu, because I got an anchor. That's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. One drunk meets another, where we get each other. And he was one of the first who talked to me about getting right, and he used the words higher power. About getting a higher power, finding a higher power. Now, Peter, what has worked for you, what you've been trying to get to work for you up until this point, you've been a miserable failure, is what he told me. And those were hard words to swallow, but they were true. There is nothing wrong with us coming to terms with what we've done thus far has been a failure. There's victory in that. The mind says, don't do that because you are a failure. No. If I'm struggling trying to put up a painting and I can't get it level, I go to a carpenter and say, listen, I just can't get this up there. And he says, do it this way. And I have a painting hanging on the wall. No shame in that. I do that with God, with my life. Father, I've been trying. I've blown this apart. Can you show me how to do this? I'm tired. And then the teachers appear. And that's how we go from having life run on self-will and an unmanageable life to being in line with God, and suddenly life appears and feels to be manageable because we're not managing it. Make sense? Okay. So agnostics. Just want to pull a couple of things out of here. It says in the preceding chapters we have learned something of alcoholism, right? Bill's story, there's a solution. More about alcoholism, which is aimed right at the mind. We hope we've made clear the distinction between the alky and the non-alky. Our book uses words like real alcoholic, alcoholics of our type, chronic, in this class. They keep separating us from the normies out there. I've heard other people tell this story, and I thought they were making it up until a bunch of years ago when I started to travel and go speak around. And then I got them. I get on planes a lot. You probably identify with this. And for some reason, God must be like Henny Youngman up there, because he loves doing these gags on me. I sit down trying to mind my business, got a 2-hour flight, and then they do the service card. And I always get the guy in my vision who orders those little Mickey Mouse drinks on the plane. Now, if you're on the plane, now, if you're an alcoholic, you're not even going to bother unless they're going to bring a vat of that stuff. And what he does, he's got 400 magazines, right? And he's got them there in his newspaper, and he's reading, and he orders the thing with a glass of water, a cup of water, and like 2 pounds of ice in this thing. And you know what he does, right? He doesn't get it and gobble it right down and order another. He reads his magazine. Now, I'm watching this event take place. And then at some point, when he's good and ready, he opens it up, and he pours a splash into all this ice and water. And then what does he do afterwards? He goes back and reads his magazine. And then at some point during this incredible event, he does this. And I'm saying, what was the R all about? You drank a glass of water. And then he goes back to reading. I do not identify with these alcohol abusers. I don't get it. Right. I need to drink. So I've learned something of my alcoholism by being out there. And I learned something more about it by being in here when I was given considerations. Did I have control over the stopping and the starting? Do I have control over the stopping and starting of a spree? Or am I completely powerless? Right. In the preceding chapters, you learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alky and the non-alky. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely for good, or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. Our book doesn't say you are. It says you probably are. and it's a self-diagnosis. If this is the case that I am an alky, and I've come to terms with that, they're so delicate right here for a book that is so clear-cut, precise, and specific. They're really delicate here. If that's the case, it says you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience would conquer. It's like a velvet hammer with the head here. You may be suffering from an illness, and here's the warning, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. We're not going to deal with it. We're going to conquer. We'll become victorious, which means I have to do some other things. Okay, you have anything? Just jump. To one who feels he's an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. So I had to learn what an agnostic was. I had no idea when I came in here. My sponsor says, go get a dictionary. I'm not going to enable you. And for me, the way I interpret this is an agnostic is one who doesn't deny the existence of God. You just can't prove it. It's not tangible enough for me. And anytime I'm in that place, I, in order to deal with life on life's terms, I'm in self-reliance. An atheist is one who doesn't believe there is a God. In fact, they have more belief than a lot of folks in AA because they're convinced there is no God. That's their belief, and they'll argue, and they'll give you a good argument for it. Where the agnostic in AA is wavering. And Scripture says I can't be wavering because then I'm like the ocean that gets pushed around by the wind. I'm never grounded. I need to stand for something or fall for anything. And then we have the one who believes. And how do we come to believe based on experience? How did I come to believe that I was in love with Jack Daniels? Because I drank it and it worked and I went back for more. Right? To one who feels he's atheist, agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But continue as we are means disaster. Especially if I'm the alcoholic of the hopeless variety, where I'm beyond power, choice, and control. Where I'm beyond having even a powerful desire to keep me from drinking. When even when you put consequences in front of me, and I know I'm going to lose her, I'm going to lose my job, but I still need to drink. I've got to drink. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Bottom of the page it says, if a mere code of morals, a better philosophy of life was sufficient to overcome alcoholism, we would have recovered long ago. So if I found the right relationship, if I went back to my religious community, if I did something that replaced my drinking, and that worked for me, I would never be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have gone through 7 treatment centers. I would have done something that kind of floated my boat and I'd be okay now. But I'm a real alcoholic. And time away from a drink doesn't mean I'm cured, because my mind will trickle me back to that which is killing me. I need something that's going to save me. Not a quick fix or temporary relief, because I'm that desperate and that hopeless. The guy without power, choice, and control. And here it is. Page 45 says, lack of power, that was our dilemma, my problem. I had to find a power by which I could live, not just not drink. That's why I don't tell anyone in my lineage, never told, and I don't tell the new prospects, live life on life's terms. That's middle of the road AA. You know how I live life on life's terms? I need a drink. I need something to allow me to go out there to that insanity that's out there and do life. Life on God's terms is open, easy, inclusive, never exclusive. God's not going to give me more than I think I can handle. God will give me a kick and God will give me a push and God will prune the tree, but not to hurt me. When I do life on life's terms, the only one who's hurting me is me, because the unmanageability, by the way, is always an internal condition, guys. It's never out there. It's easy to blame everyone for my unmanageability, but it's based on my perceptions and conceptions about everything that's upside down. Lack of power is my dilemma. I had to find a power by which I could live, and it had to be a power greater than myself. Where and how am I going to find this power? That's what this book is about. It's going to point me through. I got a GPS in my car. I pop the address in. It tells me how to get there, right to the door. This is what this book's about to do. You're lost. You need God. We're going to show you exactly what we did to experience God. Go ahead.
I'm just thinking about some old-time things that we talk about in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember hearing, I came, came to and I came to believe. And in that process, I mean, it was like all these amazing things started happening. And also, God brings us to AA and AA brings us to God. I'm a firm believer in that. I was sitting in treatment, and I'm at this place where I'd worked my first step, and I know at that point, okay, I'm powerless. And God started doing for me things that I couldn't do for myself. They would talk about, a coincidence is when God does something and remains anonymous. You know, and I had a woman that showed up to be, because I worked the first step, I got to go to an outside meeting, and I knew one person that was in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was this guy that worked with my ex-husband. His wife was in AA, and so it just so happened that she shows up to be my first sponsor. You know, I walk outside, she's taking me to a meeting, here it is, Dawn, sitting there. It's like, wow, how did that happen? You know, and if you're new here, I mean, I hope you're open to those things that God starts doing. So she takes me to a meeting, and my mind was trying to take me out over and over again. We get down to this meeting. It's this place called Dry Dock, and the floors are like this, and there's these clanky radiators and loud trains going by, and the room full of smoke and crusty old people, and I'm going, great, I've arrived, you know? And going to this room with this sponsor that God brings into my life, you know, my mind kept trying to push me out the doors. And I came into that room that night, and there was a woman, I don't know if I have ever seen her again in my entire life, but she was sitting up against the room, and they called on her to speak, and she was this Native American woman, and it was that experience again, like it happened at the end of the bed. She was talking about wanting to be a good mom, and she couldn't. She was talking about how she felt about herself inside her skin and how she hated herself. And she started telling, it was me. It was me. And they say that in the rooms too, you know. You know, you just keep coming back and you'll hear your story. I'm a big believer in that. That woman, that night, okay, first of all, God does this miracle. This woman shows up to be my temporary sponsor, the only woman I know on the planet in AA besides my little sister came in before that. But they're not going to give me her, you know. And the only person I know sober shows up to be my sponsor. Wow. And my alcoholic mind wants to go, still on the way to the meeting, go and walk in the door, and I still want to think, I'm not going to be a part of this thing. And then this woman shares her story. And so over and over again, God kept revealing himself to me, you know. I remember going outside for a walk and the trees, it's November. And for the first time in my life, you know, I got sober in November, and it'll always be special to me, in Northwest Washington. And it was like the leaves were orange and they were bold and they were bright. And it felt like there was just, I was seeing him for the first time. And we ran out and we got on the swings and we're swinging together and with just big smiles on our face, like, oh my God, I'm alive. You know, and so that was part of my process of coming to and coming to believe, like, you know, you open your life up to that, living that experience, whatever your experience is gonna be with God, you know. And it wasn't somebody beating me over the head, it was more that I was open and willing. I can't take any credit for it. It just kept showing up.
A great assignment to take to, in order to take a look at our current agnosticism, which can really help us with setting us up when we get to four, and it was asked, I was asked to do it by my sponsors, is I take a look at areas in my life that I'm unwilling to give to God, and why? What am I afraid of? I'm willing to give my booze problem to God. I'm willing to give my drug problem to God, but the money problem, I don't know. My relationship life, I don't know. My career life, I don't know. And I list, what am I afraid of? And usually it comes down to, it's not going to work out the way I planned. And when that happens, I have some self-reliance, which means I'm agnostic, which means that's unmanageable, because the more I squeeze, the further. It's like trying to have a cup of, pour water in your hand and cup it, and then make a fist to hold on to it. You lose it. So it's a great assignment for me to do, where I believe God's working, where I don't believe God's working. Another assignment I was given to do right in step two is, what was my old conception of God growing up? What did that look like? What's my current conception of God look like right now, as I'm writing? And how I would like to have this God appear to me in the future. What would that relationship, how do I want it to be in the future? A loving God, a parenting God. I want to be, as Scripture says, childlike in front of, around this God. Mm. How do I want it to be? And I got to look at the past. Was this somebody was out there watching every move I made. And I was always going to hell. Every time I turn around, I'm going to hell. I was told, you're going to hell. You're cursed, you're going to hell. You thought about something, you're going to hell. You act like you're going to hell. I said, well, how could they claim to have this loving God when he's always punishing me? And for me, at 14 years old, my mom suffers from alcoholism, several attempts at suicide, and finally succeeds in taking a life. I said, this isn't such a loving God. He's a judge. And by the time I'm in my late teens and 20s, I despise God. In fact, I thought God was for weak and cowardly people, perhaps old people. And the belief systems I grew up with is that a real man don't need God. God is for women. They're the weakest sex. Men don't need this. That's how I was grown up. Children should be going to God. They're innocent. They don't know better. But a real man, you don't bow. You don't kneel before God. He's cruel anyway. Don't need it. And then I was brought to my knees in June of 88. And that same God that I spat at and cursed, that I begged for mercy, everything changed for the better. Bless you. It tells me when we're talking about God that difficulty is going to arise with agnostics. So I like to think I was an agnostic. I never denied the existence of this power. I always knew there was something out there. Just no relation to it. There was no integration, no oneness with God. God was somewhere out there, and while I'm walking this earth, I got to do what I have to do. The difficulty that they talk about arises with alcoholics is not God with us. It's always us with God. It was me with God based on my ideas. On page 27, it says, our ideas, attitudes, and emotions were once the guiding force of the lives of these men, are cast aside for new set that dominate us. What sort of ideas, attitudes, and emotions am I approaching life with or God with? What's driving me? At the end of the day, it is always fear of the unknown. Because that's the only place fear points to, the only place where fear lives, is in the future, the unknown. What are they going to think about me over what happened last night? What's going to happen down the road? How long am I going to live? How much money am I going to have? How's this going to go? How's this weekend going to go? What are people going to think of me? Am I going to get that promotion? Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I'm going to die. The evil and corroding thread, the fabric of our existence, our book says, was shot through with it. Fear. When we get to inventory part of this, you will see that our entire inventory, in fact, every inventory we write, whatever we're writing about, if we dropped it in a funnel and one word would come out, it would be fear. The whole inventory is about fear. Fear wearing different hats, different ties, different places, different scenes, different neighborhoods, different towns, different area codes, different zip codes, fear. Always, all the time. I'm basically like an adult walking around a 56-year-old body, but in reality, I'm an 8-year-old in the shopping mall who can't find mama. And I'm just running around like a chicken without a head. But I can't let you know that. And that's how most of us are walking, going through life. Always in fear. Is she staying? Is she going? Is he staying? Is he going? Am I going to get promoted? Am I going to get fired? Am I going to have money? No money. Am I going to get sick? When am I going to die? No, I'm going to die. I'm going to die any day now. Does anyone identify with this as alcoholics? You get a little tickle in the back of your throat and you know you got cancer, you got 6 months to go. Yes. And if I'm miserable, you're going to be miserable too. And if you just tell me it's a little sore throat, I hate you because you don't think I'm going to die. Okay. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It's an arrival point, and they're telling us what happened, that we're going to get to this place of sanity. Came to believe that this power greater than me is going to restore me to wholeness of mind, to truth, to God. going to restore me to sanity, going to restore me back to love, going to restore me back to patience, going to restore me back to humility, going to restore me back to sanity, going to restore me back to strength, going to restore me back to godliness. But there's a process involved in certain requirements I must meet, that I must meet, that I get to meet. So when they paint me into a corner, they throw out step two and they say, listen, we're going to get you to a place where you're going to be returned to sanity. There's a couple of fellows who did this for years. They're all gone now. And they would always say this at their workshops. If I need to be restored to sanity, it must mean I was insane somewhere. And it wasn't the things I did when I was out on a drunk or some of us on a crack run or whatever run we were on. The things we do when we're doing that. It's being sober. And the mind's sober, and the mind says a drink would fix it. So to illustrate that, I'm coming out of my fifth treatment center. I was in my fifth treatment center for 9 weeks. 9 weeks in treatment. I put on some weight, had color back in my face, I was able to hold some food, I was actually sleeping, and I had no post-acute withdrawal syndrome going on. If you gave me a UA, I was clean, gave me a breathalyzer, clean, I was good. My body did not need alcohol or any other substance. Get it? Didn't need it. There was no withdrawal. 9 weeks in treatment. But the mind, where my unmanageability is manufactured daily for free, there was nothing done with that because there was no spiritual connection yet. I was dry. I was abstinent. I don't do well with abstinence. So 9 weeks in treatment. I got discharged on a Saturday. I'll never forget it. And for 2 days, I experienced what I heard, white-knuckle sobriety. Full of anxiety, sweating, couldn't sleep, tossing and turning. I was hypersensitive. Everything was loud. I couldn't really articulate how I was feeling. I was just a bundle of nerves, raw nerve. For 2 days, I was like this. Monday morning, I went to downtown Brooklyn, where my liquor store was, right? And I waited for him to show up. He showed up, and I'm pacing back and forth outside the liquor store. He finally shows up, puts the key in, rolls the metal fence up. I'm in there, put my money underneath the glass partition, a pint of Mr. Boston Blackberry Brandy. I get my pint, I run outside, I remember this like it was yesterday, I run outside, twist it off, and I drink it down as if I was dying of thirst and needed water. I felt like my body was in craving. I felt like I was needing a drink and sick without a drink. There was nothing wrong with my body. But my mind had some other plans. It said, yeah, you need a drink. So powerful that I actually felt sick. If there's any cocaine guys in here or ladies, what happens on your way to cop cocaine? You have to make a stop in the restroom, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
How did that happen? There was nothing wrong with you an hour ago. Stomach was fine. Got the stuff in your hand. Uh-oh. How does that happen? How could it be after 9 weeks of being in treatment, my body didn't need a drink, that suddenly my mind says, yeah, you do. And I'm guzzling it. I remember this. And any alky will identify with this. When it finally got in, and I kept taking swigs off that pint, and it finally hit, the reaction is this. I can breathe. Thank you, God. I drink to feel alive. I drink just to feel. I drink just to talk. I drink just to be. Because without it, I can't. And after 9 weeks of being in treatment, my mind said, you need a drink. And my body says, you're right. And it felt like I needed a drink. That is unmanageability. That is my life run on self-will. Being restored to sanity, that same mind has been renewed, remade, reconstructed, or died. And what is given birth to is a godly mind. And that same mind that was telling me, you need to drink, will not talk to me in that language anymore. It tells me, go work for somebody. Go serve, be a servant. Bring love and tolerance. The same mind. But now what's behind it is God. This is the miracle for people like us, where we were driven to drink, regardless of whatever, that after 9 weeks of being in treatment, my body felt like it needed a drink, all coming from this wonderful predator called the mind, and that's just what it is. The mind is a predator. If there were predators out on the property, they would call the police, but with us, we invite them in, because it's our mind. But through this renewal, that mind is not telling me to drink anymore. I'm not buying the lie. It's not feeding me a lie. And therefore, I'm not drinking, which means I've been set free. And now, how free do I want to be? And as I continue with the rest of this work, and I start to discover the great reality deep down in here, I don't have to go out there and find it. It has been here all along. When I was on my worst drunk, I had just as much God in me as the Pope in Rome. That goes for all of us. It's the integration or the oneness with God we're lacking. We can't be left out of God's universe. We're not separate from that power, which we already are. But there's no communication. We're not listening. God's always pursuing. God is begging to have a relationship with everyone in this room. God's begging to have a relationship with every one of his children in and out of the rooms. We're not listening. We were born to be saints. My sponsor always said, let us start acting like it. My plans and designs are just that, plans and designs. They have no value, they have no depth, they have no weight. But when I get in line with God through the surrender, suddenly I'm able to accomplish great things. Like bathing a couple of times a day. Like putting food in my belly. Like having a clean place. Like going to work 5 days a week and giving my employer 40 hours. Sometimes longer. And not expecting a parade at the end of the day. I'm serious. With me? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. At first it was just this conception, this idea. It has come to be a reality. Not that he could, he has. Could restore us to sanity? Once we have this experience, we're convinced it has happened, and then we bear witness for others. But there's some work involved. Am I willing to get to this place of wholeness of mind? Am I willing to follow the road that points to the solution? And if I am, what I simply do is make that connection, make that commitment to this God and say, yep, my life is yours. You're going to do whatever you want. Yep, I'm going to live on the way you want me to, whichever direction you send me. And we have a beautiful third step and some third step considerations, which we'll do when we come back from a break. Thanks. Thank you.